Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. It's an hour of musical surprises. Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann were a hit songwriting team in the 60s, but even if you know their names, you may be surprised at the sheer range of famous songs they wrote. We'll hear from them later. We've also got live music from Jessica Lee Mayfield, whose albums have been squarely in the alt-country camp until now. She unveils a much darker, harder rock sound on her new record, and you'll hear that in her band's live set. And to begin, here's a musical story so surprising that many of us thought at first it must have been a joke. I'm talking about Rocky the Musical. Now, when I first read that the film Rocky was going to be made into a musical in Germany, I had to double-check the date to make sure it wasn't April 1st. But before you could say, "Yo, Adrian," it became evident that the producers were serious about it. So they hired some serious musical talent and one of America's hottest young theater directors. And now, like Rocky himself, this musical underdog is a big hit. On Broadway, at the Winter Garden Theater to be precise, Alex Timbers is the director of Rocky the Musical. He joins me here in the Soundcheck studio. Hi, Alex.
Thanks so much for having me.
When you were first approached about this, what did you think? I mean, it's a story of an underdog. Did you think you were taking on an underdog here?
Well, actually, to back up even further, when I heard Rocky as a musical, I thought this was a crazy idea. I mean, I think most people involved with the show had that same sort of reaction. And, you know, you sort of think, well, I don't know, this is what musical theater doesn't do well. It's like sports and, you know, and having, you know, and sort of like butch guys on stage singing, like, what is that? But then I actually saw a reading of the show, and I was blown away by the emotionality, because what you forget is that it's actually a love story with boxing as a backdrop. And so as soon as you know, I sort of locked into that underdog story, and that, you know, it's such a human, such an American story, so relatable, that you see how musical theater can do that well. And then the trick was figuring, well, how can musical theater do boxing well? Mm. And that was a real challenge.
Had you seen the film?
I hadn't seen the film beforehand.
I mean, you would have been like a little kid when that movie first came out.
It was before I was born, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
So not even a little kid. You've seen it now.
I've seen it now, yeah. You know, I think as a director, you don't want to emulate the film too much. You don't want it to feel like a museum piece, right?
Yeah.
So you sort of get into the script as a dramatic text, and you start designing it. And then you look at the film because you don't want to deny all the amazing stuff in there. But it's sort of an amalgam. It feels true to the film, but feels also very original on stage, I think, I hope.
Yeah. Now, the one thing that people cannot stop talking about is the final scene.
Oh, cool.
Where this, like, this coup de théâtre that you guys pull off. Can you, without, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but can you sort of explain what happens?
Yeah, you know, the thought was that if you as an audience member are really loving the story of Rocky and Adrian, how cool would it be to suddenly enter the narrative in the final 20 minutes? And so when we get to that final fight between Rocky and Apollo, we go from what we consider sort of in a proscenium setup where you're watching the stage from a fixed position, and we go to in the round. We get some of the audience up on stage, push the ring out into the middle of the audience, drop down a jumbotron, and suddenly you're watching the ring is, you know, basically in your lap, and we have live video going, and it sort of feels like you're really at a sporting arena.
Right. You're at a boxing match, and you're sitting in the round or in the square, as the case may be.
And, exactly.
And, you know, in the original cast recording for Rocky the Musical, which comes out on May 27th, we actually get to hear some of the action during this final fight.
Oh, cool.
We hear a couple of announcers who are, like, looking down on the action and kind of talking us through it. The album comes out on May 27th. Here's a little bit.
Politics, left lands, right to Rocky's jaw, and now both men start really going at it. Standing toe to toe and exchanging punch after punch. Only seconds left in the fight. And now Balboa is taunting the champion, daring him to throw his best punch. An exchange of lefts and rights from Apollo that would have knocked out anyone else. But Rocky continues to shake them off and battle back, countering the champ punches blow for blow. I've never seen anything like it. Nobody has.
The Fight is the name of that track from the original cast recording for Rocky the Musical, featuring a score by Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty, but incorporating the Bill Conti song.
Absolutely,
gonna fly
yeah.
Now. The director, Alex Timbers, is with me here on Soundcheck. And you talk about, you know, moving the set out and moving the audience, dropping the Jumbotron as if, yeah, it's just another day at the office.
Yeah, of course. You know, you spend about a year pre-visualizing the whole thing. So we have a little sort of computer animated graphics that we figure out exactly how long it'll take to do this and how long it'll take to do that. Of course, when you get in the theater, everything changes immediately.
Now it becomes, yeah. It's no longer computer graphics. Now you have to make it real.
Yeah, and then you figure out that a 70-year-old patron actually takes, 20 seconds to go up a stairwell, instead of, 15 or whatever.
Right,
and then you figure things out.
Now, is it true that the boxing ring portion of the stage, the movement of that stage, that this was inspired by a Nine Inch Nails concert?
Yeah. Well, I had seen this this concert video of the With Teeth tour, and they had a grid, the structure that holds all the lighting above, and it would lower and raise and tip and tilt. And we had this problem where we there's a fight at the beginning, there's a fight at the end, there's not a fight in between, and so you have this ring that has to disappear for most of the show. And we couldn't sink it into the floor. It's too big to get on the ring. I didn't want it to break apart, because you want the integrity of the ring to feel mm-hmm. real. This is an authentic, gritty, masculine show. And so we decided to pick it up and fly it and suck it up into the grid. And it comes down and can tilt and become the bottom of the ring can become a projection surface or can become the roof of different scenes. It's really interesting, the things it can do.
Yeah. And the audience has become part of the concept. I mean, obviously in Rocky, the audience is, by the end, they're the audience at a fight.
Yeah.
And in your other production, which is currently running, Here Lies Love, based on the David Byrne Fatboy Slim album,
mm-hmm.
the audience is even more involved.
Yeah, well, this is a show about another historical figure. It's about Imelda Marcos and her reign over the Philippines. But it's not done in a camp way. It's not
right.
about the shoes. And what's interesting about it is there's no dialogue throughout. It's just these sort of club songs back to back. And the audience stands for the duration of the show while the performers are on platforms and levels all around them. And there are 22 channels of video. It feels like a club experience. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to cast the audience as a participant in the drama, so that when Marcos is having his rallies, you're there cheering on the dictator.
Mm-hmm.
When Benigno Aquino is shot, you actually join his funeral procession. So you are it's not quite like Sleep No More, where you move from room to room. I mean, you are in one space, but you are cast as a role in the show.
Right. And it's, in the early days, at least, when David Byrne was writing the piece,
mm-hmm.
he referred to it as a disco opera
uh-huh.
and a dance party. I mean, you're talking about the audience standing, but a lot of people are dancing.
Oh, yeah. Throughout, I mean, it is this club music, and we do try to, we try to emulate the things that will get you moving, the sense of anonymity, and we have I'm sure the busiest subwoofer is off Broadway.
So now that show, Here Lies Love, is at the Public Theater with music from David Byrne and Fatboy Slim and a cast of thousands, it seems. Let's hear a little bit from the original cast recording of that show. This song's called Dancing Together.
Golf course and flowers, statues and stables. Together, dancing, oh, as if in a dream.
Dancing Together is the name of the song from Here Lies Love, music by David Byrne with Fatboy Slim, directed by Alex Timbers. It's up at the Public Theater. And as we're sitting here in the Soundcheck studio, Alex, you were saying you haven't even heard that verse before. So, I mean, this is a show that's gone through several kind of iterations over the course of the last couple of years.
Yeah, it started out as this double CD, and when we made the theatrical version of it, probably about a third of the songs were cut and a third new songs were added, and then a lot of the songs were condensed and tweaked, to form more theatrical forms, because some of the pop songs are long. So yeah, and that last verse, it's not in the show. It's great, only on the album. It's terrific.
Now, it strikes me that, the story of Imelda Marcos in Here Lies Love, this disco opera by David Byrne, when he first started talking about it, it sounded as implausible as turning Rocky into a musical, you know? But in both of them, there's this kind of emotional undercurrent that actually brings you through the story. For you, did you make that connection? Was that...
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, I think with a musical, the key is that, is that emotional relationship you have to... I mean, it can't just be like a movie where something looks, where sometimes it doesn't have emotional... And it just looks really cool and it's a fun sensory experience. With a musical, it's got to have a strong emotional line, even if it seems gussied up in this way that's just, in unconventional and fun,
Well, in both shows, in Rocky the Musical and in Here Lies Love, we've talked about the audience participation, which is ramped up to 11 in the in Here Lies Love. What is it? Is there something in your background, in your experience as a theater goer or a concert goer that got you thinking about involving the audience that way?
I don't know. I just feel like it's a little bit of a part of what today is, where you can vote on American Idol and change the experience of what you're having. You have an iPad. Everything feels responsive to your touch. And I think that entertainment, particularly theater, where you are live there, of course you should be a part of the outcome of the event. I'm someone who does not actually like audience participation. So I don't like being dragged up on stage and humiliated or being asked questions. So, all of this stuff is done through the lens of no one's ever singled out or made to feel like they have to do something they don't. I never want the audience to feel like if they don't want to cheer Rocky on or if they don't want to dance with Imelda that they're failing in any way. You can also just sit in the corner and watch happily. That to me is a rule of whenever I'm doing this stuff.
So do you vote for American Idol? Are you a pop culture junkie?
I do love pop culture. I don't watch American Idol. But that would be the distinction.
Yeah. But the idea of theater as a part of pop culture, that certainly was the case in the 19-teens, perhaps to the 1950s or 60s.
Yeah.
Now it seems to be something off to the side. Are you deliberately attempting to make that connection again?
I think you're right. I think there's a gulf between popular culture and musical theater. Musical theater feels irrelevant. I think theater in general feels irrelevant to, the sort of the larger cultural dialogue in America. And to me, I love theater. And so I feel I'm sort of an activist for it. And to me, drawing on the kind of visuals and music and comedy you see in a mainstream film or a music video, to me feels important when I'm doing a play.
And so you're not just doing plays. I mean, you've done some film and TV projects. Mm-hmm. We've talked on Soundcheck in the past about Mozart in the Jungle.
Oh, really?
Going all the way back to the original book.
Oh, terrific.
And so you're directing that that Amazon original TV series.
Well, I'm one of the co-writers of it. It just started the pilot's been out. And,
right.
The writing process for the season just began on Monday, so it's very exciting. It's going to shoot here in New York.
And is that is that a completely different animal from working on Broadway or even off Broadway?
So far, I mean, I'm completely new to this, so I'm an innocent. But so far, it seems completely different. But it's fun, It's also all this stuff is story and emotion based.
Yeah. Is there more film, more TV in the future for you? You think?
I'm not sure. I mean, I live in New York, so Broadway is the Broadway and off Broadway. It's my home.
Yeah. And so one of your other projects, Up Here, musical with with Bobby Lopez, Robert Lopez, and Kristen Anderson Lopez, huge hit with the musical, the music in Frozen.
Yes.
And we know Bobby from his work with Book of Mormon as well and Avenue Q. So what is Up Here?
Up Here's great. I mean, you know, and the success that these guys have had is, you know, we were talking about this right before. I mean, it could not happen to nicer people, which is always like a wonderful, happy karmic thing in the world. But Up Here is a show we've been working on for 7 years, which means that he's probably and she's probably been working on it for 9-10 years, you know. It's a romantic comedy, a boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back, but with a big conceptual gloss over it, a big sort of almost Cirque gloss over it. And it reminds me kind of a 70s Woody Allen film, you know, where there's something very intimate going on, but also something epic at the same time.
And when do we see that?
That's next summer in La Jolla in California.
All right. In the meantime, though, plenty of opportunities to see Alex Timber's work. Rocky the Musical has an open-ended run at the Winter Garden Theater, and Here Lies Love, with music by David Byrne and Fatboy Slim, is at the Public Theater as well. Original cast recording for Rocky the Musical comes out on May 27th. Alex, great having you with us today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Up next, after starting her career with a rootsy sound, Jessica Lee Mayfield talks about the hard-edged new direction she's exploring on her new record. And she'll play live in our studio. Later, I'll profile another great early electronic album of the 70s and 80s. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. It's always interesting to hear an artist's sound evolve over time, particularly one who got started as young as Jessica Lee Mayfield did. After touring in a bluegrass band with her family as a kid, Jessica caught the ear of the Black Keys' Dan Auerbach, who produced her first two full-length albums, both of which fell firmly into alt-country territory. But her latest release is a step away and a step toward guitar-heavy alternative rock. The new album is called Make My Head Sing, and today Jessica Lee Mayfield is here with her band to play some of it for us live in the studio. This first song is called No Fun. It's Jessica Lee Mayfield live on Soundcheck. We'll be right back. That is Jessica Lee Mayfield live on Soundcheck with a song called No Fun that appears on her latest album called Make My Head Sing. And you heard Jessica singing and playing the guitar, Jesse Newport playing the bass, and Matt Martin behind our drum kit here in the Soundcheck studio. Jessica Lee Mayfield is my guest, and this is a big change, Jessica, from what you've done before. I mean, people who've heard you on Prairie Home Companion, for example, or heard the first two records might be thinking, wow, is this even the same person? Is this sound, has this been kind of percolating for a while?
You know, I feel like a lot of people that are fans of my music aren't, that are like, actually, the real actual fans aren't surprised. And like you're saying, maybe the people that may have caught me perchance on Prairie Home Companion,
right,
when they were listening to see Ricky Skaggs or whatever, they're like, well, this is different. But I think, you know, the thing that is consistent is the songwriting, and that it is in fact, you know, me. And I don't know, and I feel like it's weird, like when the last record came out, everybody was like, oh, this one is so much different from the first one. And I think it's hard for, I guess change is hard for people. And some people go their whole entire life with the same haircut and the same pants that they bought in 1995 that still fit.
Why are you looking at me when you say that?
No, but I am saying that some people get it, you know, like my husband wore the same pair of Doc Martens from when he was 15 until this past year, and I got him a new pair because they were blown out.
That would be bass player Jesse
Jesse Newport, who's here. But, you know, but there comes I guess for me, I've always been just open to everything, mm-hmm, musically and all aspects of life.
There's a kind of, you know, people have noticed a kind of a grungy 90s alternative sound to this new record. Is that... I mean, you were a little kid in the 90s when this was kind of... You're born in what, 89?
Uh-huh.
So when did you come to this music?
I probably started... I would say when I was about 11 and 12 was when I got real into, you know, all the grunge.
Okay.
They used to show music videos on this... TV channel called MTV.
Oh, yeah.
And also there's this one called VH1, and they also, and I mean, you would turn it on and there would just be music videos all day long, and there was still, you know, and I got to see every video for every band that I like, you know, and then Nirvana videos and Metallica videos. And
how was this received at home? Because as you've already mentioned, you grew up in a bluegrass family. Your brother David, both of your parents, they still tour. They still play.
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess when I was a kid, there was a slight bit of reluctancy to my musical choices. Just mainly Metallica was the big one that my family was really, really was worried about. But mm-hmm, then they kind of, you know, they've always my parents have always treated me as an equal ever since I was a child, and we all worked together.
Mm-hmm.
And we played music together, and, you know, to support the family, and everybody took care of themselves. It wasn't that kind of mother-father relationship where they, you know, oh, we got to make money and send you off to school. I didn't go to school. I was homeschooled, and we all just worked together to support the family as a whole.
Hmm.
So they've always respected me, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Well, you know, your parents' website, it's the cutest thing. It's like they spend...
Oh, no, I don't know if I've seen their website.
They spend a fair amount of time on their website touting their kids, and your brother David, you know.
My mom and dad are 10 times more tech savvy than I am. Like, they're on the internet all the time. I'm like... Like, I'll call my mom. I'll be like, how are you doing? And she'll be like, did you see the flower garden? And I'll be like, no. And she'll be like... It's on the internet. I'm like, I gotta go find a picture. You know, it's like she we don't have anything to talk about unless like I'm like following her on social media,
yeah,
and I have a hard time having the attention span for that. I forget. I'm like, oh wait, I have an Instagram. I need to check it this week. It's like a P.O. box.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you're obviously doing well with the electronics, you know, the foot pedals and all the gear that comes with playing an electric guitar.
All my guitar pedals from the 80s.
Well, let's put them back to work. You want to do a song called Pure Stuff?
Let's make it happen.
All right. We're speaking with Jessica Lee Mayfield. Her latest album is called Make My Head Sing. Here's a song called Pure Stuff, played live on Soundcheck.
Stop.
That is Jessica Lee Mayfield and Pure Stuff live in the Soundcheck studio. Jessica singing and playing guitar, Jesse Newport on bass, Matt Martin on drums. That song appears on Jessica's latest album called Make My Head Sing. It is out now. It's been great fun having you in the band here with us. Thanks very much.
We had a really good time. Thanks for having us.
It's not going to stay, so don't even try.
I recently posted a list of some of my favorite early electronic albums from the 70s and 80s, and we'll zoom in on one of those albums in just a moment. And later, my conversation with songwriting team Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. This is Soundcheck. This week, we're looking back at some classic electronic albums from the 70s and 80s, whose sound has begun to resurface in a fair amount of recent recordings and mixtapes by younger artists. Those vintage synthesizers by Moog and Arp and Oberheim are suddenly back in vogue. But if you want to hear what they sounded like the first time around, a good place to start is with the German trio known as Tangerine Dream. They've made over 100 albums at this point, not including their various solo projects. But in the mid-70s, they made famous the long-form synthesizer-based style that came to be known as krautrock. What can I say? The politically correct movement hadn't gotten into full swing then. But Tangerine Dream had. Records like this one, Stratosphere, were propelled by a relentless electronic rhythm. That's some of the title track from the German group Tangerine Dream and their 1976 album, Stratosphere. That's Fear, spelled F-E-A-R, by the way. Tangerine Dream's sound, especially that motoric rhythm, has had a huge impact on the world of EDM, electronic dance music. It also, by the way, helped build the Virgin Empire. This was one of three albums Tangerine Dream did for Virgin Records in the mid-70s. They all sold well and helped establish Richard Branson's brand, which of course would go on to become a book publisher, an airline, a chain of record stores, a mobile phone company, and now a fledgling space tourism corporation. So when you finally take that trip on Spaceship One out into orbit, you can thank Tangerine Dream for doing their part to make Virgin Galactic possible. Meanwhile, you can hear a full track from Stratosphere and see the rest of my list of 10 classic electronic albums from the 70s and 80s on our website, soundcheck.org. The Tony Awards are set for Sunday, June 8th, and among this year's nominees is Beautiful, the Carole King musical. It received 7 nods, including Best Musical and Best Book, and as the full name implies, Beautiful is the story of singer-songwriter Carole King and her tempestuous relationship with her former husband and songwriting partner Jerry Goffin. But it also tells the story of their real-life friends, Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, also a married couple and also hitmakers. These Rock and Roll Hall of Famers wrote songs like On Broadway, We Gotta Get Out of This Place, and You've Lost That Loving Feeling, among many others. I talked to Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil about Beautiful back in January. How weird is it seeing your early lives depicted on stage?
I love it. I mean, you know, also the actors who play us are so good, and the lines that were written for them are so good that I love it.
The Barry Mann character, played by Jared Spector, yeah, he gets all the best lines in the show.
Well, I guess, that's what happens in life also with my wife and myself.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Now, they do, Cynthia, sort of play Barry up as a kind of hopeless mass of neurotic hypochondria. How much of that? Tell me that that's like artistic.
It's 100%. You know, we gave them all the input, and Doug put it down on paper and wrote it the way it was. He's better now, right, but he was a mess of neurotic hypochondria.
The musical is called Beautiful, the Carole King musical, and it tells the story of Carole King and Jerry Goffin on the one hand, and you two on the other. Why were there, it seemed like there were a number of married couples who were working in the period around what we call the Brill Building in the early 60s.
Right.
How did that happen? Why did that happen?
Well, there was us and Carol and Jerry and Jeff Barry and Ellie Greenwich.
Right.
And I don't know, I just think when you put the opposite sexes in a room to write a song, there's something very sexy about it. Things happen, you know, and they lead to marriage.
So which came first, the professional relationship or the personal one?
The personal.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Absolutely.
So that's a little bit different from the way it's presented in on the Broadway stage. They also have you guys not quite married for much of the musical.
Well, we were not quite married for a year.
Yeah.
And then, which doesn't seem like a lot of time these days to be not quite married when people stay that way for 10 years. But in those days, it was pretty shocking.
Yeah.
Both of our mothers were very upset at the fact that we shared an apartment. And I lived in an apartment building, and we shared our apartment, and the elevator men were so embarrassed by it that they used to refer to Barry as there.
Hello there.
They'd say, good morning, Miss Weil. Good morning there.
So you scandalized even the doorman and
yes,
the elevator man
yes,
in the building. So we're talking about, what, 1961 thereabouts?
Yes.
That's it, yeah.
Now, Barry, you, the connection of this married couple with the Goffin King married couple goes deeper than you had offices next door and you all cranked out all these hits. You, Barry, actually co-wrote a song with Jerry Goffin.
That's right. A song that's now, a standard that lives in the hearts of, and minds of people in the business. A song called Who Put the Bump in the Bump, Bump, Bump. And an artist sang it that I know very well, and that was me.
Let's hear Barry Mann. This is going back to, again, this is about 1961. And who put the bomb?
Who put the bomb in the bomb, a bomb, a bomb? Who put the rhyme in the ram-a-lam-a ding dong? Who put the bop in the bop, shabop, shabop? Who put the dip in the dip, dip, dip? Who was that man? I'd like to shake his hand. He made my baby fall in love with me. Yeah. When my baby heard, bom, 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 every word went right into her heart. And when she heard them singing, rama, lama, 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 ding dong, she said we'd never have to part.
Who Put the Bump, written by my guest Barry Mann, and not his longtime co-writer and wife Cynthia Weil, who's also here with me, but with Jerry Goffin, who was part of the Goffin and King team. So was this before the two married couple / songwriting teams were fully formed?
I think we started to write.
We started to write, but Jerry wrote with quite a few people at that time.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote with Jack Keller, and he wrote with you.
Right.
And he actually gave Barry that lyric as a joke.
Well, yeah.
And you thought it was funny and great and satirical. And
yeah, he hadn't finished it, and I said, this is great. And also, I realized I was on ABC Paramount as a recording artist, and I really thought this could be a hit for me. And I told them that. And, of course, I realized that it wouldn't be a career song. if Rolling Stone was around then, I wouldn't be the cover of Rolling Stone.
So it was kind of a novelty number.
I thought it was a very hip novelty song. I really did. Yeah.
Yeah. So let me ask you guys to just back up and explain the whole Brill Building thing. First of all, you and Goffin and King worked for Aldon Music. Yeah, that's Don Kirshner. Yeah. And were they actually in the physical Brill Building?
No, they were in 1650 Broadway, and the Brill Building was at 1619 Broadway. 1650 was the cheaper building. The rents were lower, and so you had more of the young publishers there who couldn't afford Brill Building rates.
Mm-hmm. And so what was the experience like working there? I mean, did you hear Carole King and Jerry Goffin's songs bleeding through the walls as you were
that
working?
That was it.
You could.
Really?
Yes, you really could. We could hear them. They could hear us.
And there were other writers, too, writing teams that you could hear, too. It was very, very exciting and very, very anxiety-producing because we were all trying to get the same record. So it was a lot of angst.
There's a moment in the musical called Beautiful, where Don Kirshner basically says, I need a song for, is it the Shirelles?
Yeah.
And I need it by 8 a.m. tomorrow.
Yeah.
And so your characters are off trying to write a song. The Carole King and Jerry Goffin characters are off trying to write a song. Did that actually happen?
Yes, that actually happened.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
We didn't always have to write in the cubicles that were there. We could go home and write too. But it did actually happen.
And the two songs that we hear in the musical that are a result of that, are they actually the ones that...
Our song was not written. The song of ours that they use, He's Sure the Boy I Love, was not written for the Shirelles, but it worked. It was the same kind of thing where the Crystals eat it by 9 o'clock tomorrow.
That's called He's Sure the Boy I Love.
And you know who's singing lead on it?
Who is singing lead on it?
Darlene Love.
Really?
Yeah,
Darlene's been on soundcheck a number of times. Amazing singer.
Yes.
Great. Great.
So that was how, and again, I'll use the term the Brill Building in a kind of generic sense.
Yes.
Sure.
The songwriting factory that was here in Manhattan. So that's how it worked, is you would have an artist and you would write to that voice or group of voices?
Yeah.
We would write what we thought would be right for that artist, but more than a factory, it was a school.
Yeah, that's
it.
I'd
was
always...
like going to Rock and Roll University.
Hmm.
And we learned from each other. We learned from Kirshner. We learned from the radio. We were sponges, just soaking up everything we could learn about writing lyrics. And as Barry has always put it, we were the bridge between Tin Pan Alley and rock and roll.
Right. And you were young, right? I mean,
oh, yeah.
I mean, Goffin and King were like 17 and 19, but you guys were young too,
yes,
right?
Yeah, we were.
I had my first hit even before I was with Alden. I had a hit when I was 19 years old, a song called She Say Doobie Doo. She say, oh, people must think I couldn't speak English. I'd put the bump and she'd say, doobie doo.
Then I came along and he started writing better lyrics.
And then we get to You've Lost That Loving Feeling, right, and things like that, and on Broadway and so many of the other hits. Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, the songwriting team, Rock and Roll Hall of Famers, with me on Soundcheck today. They've been watching themselves on the Broadway stage with Beautiful, the Carole King musical, which is currently playing at the Stephen Sondheim Theater on West 43rd Street. And they could have just done a story about Carole King and Jerry Goffin. I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's a very interesting tale.
Mm-hmm.
But you guys were such a part of that story,
yes,
it seems.
Right.
Not just as competitors, but as friends.
Yes.
Have you guys remained friends over the years?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because the story is they fall in love, they write all these hit songs, they're very young, they have kids very young,
mm-hmm.
and he's got a roving eye and some sort of instability problems,
right,
and things mm-hmm. things fall apart in a rather nasty way.
Right.
And she, of course, comes through it with Tapestry.
Yes.
You know,
mm-hmm.
25 yes. million copies sold.
Exactly.
Right.
What about for you guys? I mean, you all went through the same thing of the mid-60s, the change from factories, songwriting teams that write the songs to artists writing their own material. That was like a big sea change in the music industry, and you all had to deal with that.
Yeah, but it's interesting. I know when the English sound came in, the Beatles and everybody else, all the songwriters were worried about it, including Cynthia and myself. But if you look at our catalog, we wrote You've Lost That Loving Feeling during that period. We wrote Soul and Inspiration during that period. We wrote We Got to Get Out of This Place. So with all our fears, it didn't matter. We just kept going straight ahead, and we did great.
All right, well, you mentioned We Got to Get Out of This Place, a song that the Animals famously recorded. Let's hear some of that.
Watch my dad.
And their recording of We Gotta Get Out of This Place, a song, one of many hits written by my guests, Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. So how did the songwriting process work? Was it always, Cynthia, you're doing the lyrics and Barry, you're doing the music?
In those days, it pretty much was. I mean, after a while, Barry wrote a couple of lyrics by himself, and then I hit him over the head a few times, and he stopped doing that.
Right.
He started behaving himself.
Right. And which would happen first?
You know, it worked all different ways. Sometimes it came from a melody. Very often it came from a melody or a riff or a feel. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it came from a title. Sometimes it came from just knowing the artist that we were writing for.
Right. Was it odd to write songs? Did it ever happen that you wrote songs and did not know who was going to sing it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
What about on Broadway? Who was that written for?
Oh, that's what I was thinking about.
That was originally written for a group that Carol and Jerry were recording called
The Cookies.
Yeah. It's a girl's song, and then it got changed.
Yeah, Cynthia and I originally wrote it without Lieber and Stola. Uh-huh. You know, it had a different perspective. It was like they say the neon lights. I hear the neon lights are bright on Broadway. I hear that dreams come true there every day. I hear that life don't get you down the way it gets you in this small town. I swear I gotta get me there someday. That was the concept for a small, you know, a girls group from a small town. And then we ended up playing it for Lieber and Stola because we thought, well, maybe with the lyric change would be great for the Drifters. And they loved it, and they said, well, you know, this is could be good for the Drifters, but you have to change the lyric. So you could either write it with us, or you could go home and write it yourselves. So we jumped at the chance to write with Lieber and Stola, because they were just great writers. You know? And that's how, and it became even a much, much better song.
They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway.
Of the Drifters' version of On Broadway, written by Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, and Lieber and Stoller. Two great songwriting teams collaborating on that song, which the Drifters had a hit with, and then, of course, George Benson, years later, would have a
and that moment,
mega hit with.
That moment in All That Jazz, the Bob Fosse film, when they used the Benson record, was mind-blowing.
Yeah. So, Barry, you have been a singer. You've even done a little impromptu singing right here in our studio today. In the wake of Who Put the Bomb, you know, kind of a novelty hit, ever have any regrets that you didn't follow up on that? I mean, I know you've done some recordings and stuff, but any regrets that you didn't pursue actively a performing career?
I did pursue it, just nobody knows. I think I was probably on more labels than any artist ever. I think I was on about 14, 15
labels.
You
were on 13 labels.
13 labels. She kept count.
Yes. And each misstep was a new kind of misstep. With each label, he made a new mistake.
That's the truth.
I mean, because as writers, we wrote in different genres, he didn't have the direction that an artist should have. Who am I? What do I sing?
Now, Cynthia said something interesting that, you know, you didn't see yourselves as genre songwriters. You weren't rock and roll songwriters or R&B songwriters.
Right.
You were just songwriters.
Yes, exactly. And I don't think that the different kinds of writing were as delineated then. We never thought, oh, we can't write country. Kirshner would say Leroy Van Dyke had just had a big hit with Walk On By, and he was recording for another session, and we were told to go write for him. So we wrote a song that was pure country, and we got the record.
We'll hear a little bit of that to wrap up. We've been speaking with the songwriting team of Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. You can see their early years depicted in the new Broadway show, Beautiful, the Carole King musical, playing at the Stephen Sondheim Theater. Barry, Cynthia, this has been great fun. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's fun for us, too.
Pleasure to meet you, and it's a pleasure to be here.
And though I break away to meet you anyhow.
to say, please remember when you call. If a woman answers, hang up the phone. Don't take a chance, please don't ask for me. If a woman answers, hang up the phone. I love you, but darling, I'm not free.
Tomorrow on the show, a look inside the world of Bob Dylan obsessives, the so-called Dylanologists. Plus, the Argentine-American singer-songwriter Diego Garcia led the indie rock band Elephant for many years. He'll perform songs from his latest solo record here in our studio. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.